services together. We are going to hear a series of bills today, and we've changed the order somewhat. I'll tell you which bills we are not going to hear. We're not going to hear the very first one on the list, which is Senate Bill 818, and we are not going to hear Senate Bill 666, which is toward the end. Both of those are being carried over, or will be heard at a future time. By the way, this is the last official day for hearing Senate bills, and some of them we will be able to reschedule, but it has to be with the permission of the President. We are supposed to be finished with Senate bills. We're not going to make it. Some of them have amendments, but we're going to try to get through all of the bills that are remaining, and so we will ask perhaps that you limit your testimony so we can get through everything. So we will start with Senate bill, which is actually the last one on the list, Senate bill 598, and it's a fairly short bill. Would you like to, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 598. Would you like to describe that, please?
Yeah, briefly, Senator, thank you. We've heard this bill on the 22nd. We do have -4 amendments in your packet. This is a replacement of the bill, and I will just briefly, and I will defer to our Senator Bates to go into more detail, but this does allow the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research to establish a pharmaceutical patient assistance program. Does not require, but simply allows. It does require OHPR to consider developing, distributing materials, maintaining a directory for these patient assistance programs, and for them to contract with one or more entities to implement and operate the programs. It does allow the OHPR to accept contributions of money and assistance from private sources that agree to basically abide by the purposes of the program. It does take out any general fund appropriations from the bill and becomes effective July 1, 2005. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. One of the reasons we allow, well, we do allow people who travel long distances to testify early in the hearing, and Senator Bates travels from Ashland, and I believe he's going to Ashland after this hearing, so we want to travel while it's light. So would you please introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Alan Bates. I'm a state senator from District 3, which is Ashland, Medford, and in the interest of public safety, I think I probably should be arriving during daylight today. So I'll be leaving here directly. We've got a Pear Blossom Festival this weekend and a couple of committees meeting down there, so I appreciate the opportunity.
You have some committee meetings in Ashland.
I believe we do, and I've also got some issues with the community colleges, so we've got a lot of work to do tomorrow and Pear Blossom on Saturday, so I appreciate you allowing me to go first here. This is the Senate Bill 598-4, which the -4 amendments, which we think are, we know are agreeable to all parties now. This basically allows us to start opening up and increasing access to a program, which in my particular practice in Medford, I found to be extremely helpful to my patients. In simple terms, the pharmaceutical industry offers free drugs to people at certain levels of below certain levels of income. Those levels vary between $20,000 and $30,000 a year. For those of you not aware of how big the program is, I'd point out that our bulk purchasing system, which we're trying to get off the ground and is doing reasonably well, is going to touch 7,000 or 8,000 lives and may expand more and gives a good discount to people trying to get pharmaceuticals. The particular program I'm talking about at the present time has 100,000 enrollees in Oregon in it right now, averaging about 2.2 prescriptions per enrollee. It is a huge program, one which we want to spread further in the state if we possibly can. My particular area, we have a husband and wife team who has what we call a patient prescription aid, and for $25 they set you up in the program. For $5 per prescription, they do all the paperwork for you and for the physician. Those prescriptions are good for 90 days. My personal patients of about 100 of them who are taking part in this program absolutely love it. I get thanked for it every day when I hand a card out and they come back the next month with the prescriptions taken care of. My paper was cut down to the point that I can get the job done for them. Before, I was not able to do that. Most of my patients taking part in this program are elderly. They have a very hard time on the internet. They have a hard time getting paperwork done. It's a real hassle for them. A lot of them just give up. Have there been times when they have not gotten prescriptions because of that? So this program has worked extremely well in our area. We wanted to set up a way in which it could be spread across the state in an easier fashion. What this bill does very simply, it has no cost to the state. We will take contributions to set it up so when people call in, they'll be referred to people in their area that can do the same things being done in mine. Now, obviously, a lot of this is being done already. We've got 100,000 people in the program. A lot of this goes to individual doctors' offices, and quite frankly, patients are often brought in. They are charged a visit to get all the paperwork done, see the physician, and get things taken care of. And I would like to see that practice kind of slow down. It's much more efficient and less costly for patients to go through the kind of program I just described in my area. This has been agreed to all, by all parties. I don't know anybody's opposed to it. It doesn't need to go to Ways and Means. As I said, there's no fiscal on it. I would ask that you pass the 598-4 out. And I'd be glad to take any questions that the chair or the members might have.
Oh, yes. Senator Mona Sanderson?
Thank you, Chair. Senator Bates, where is our bulk purchasing program, and how does this interface with our bulk purchasing program?
The bulk purchasing program would be covering, for the most part, I believe, a different group. Now, these are people who are so low in income that they would be covered by this program. And the bulk purchasing program, for the most part, will probably be covering people who would not qualify for this. And there's a huge number of them out there, too. And the bulk purchasing programs lowers the cost for them to buy their drug. As an example, I mean, if you're making $10,000 or $15,000 a year and you're an elderly couple and you can get your medication completely free through this, and the bulk purchasing program obviously doesn't offer you a lot. But this is not everybody in my practice. I've got a practice of approximately 8,000 people that I've charged for. I have a couple hundred at the most in this program, and I have a large number of others who don't have insurance but don't qualify for this program, and that bulk purchasing program is going to be very important to them.
So, follow-up, just so that we avoid duplication, I think it's possible that people could possibly take advantage of drugs in the bulk purchasing, and, of course, I don't know why they would if they could get it free through this
program. I see both of these as extremely important programs, and they complement each other. They don't contradict each other. This program offers a floor. Bulk purchasing picks up the difference. The bulk purchasing pool is small. It's being rolled out. We know it's going to take time to get it out. And it's going to grow and grow and grow. 100,000 people is a lot of people, but there's 3.5 million people in Oregon, and the need out there is much greater than that. So this is not going to curtail the bulk purchasing program. They complement one another. When one leaves off, the other should pick up.
The bulk purchasing program, people 55 and older are, with 185% of poverty, are eligible for that, plus public employees and very few others. So it's limited in scope. Unless I see someone in opposition to this bill, we will move it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members.
Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 598.
Mr. Chair, I move the -4 amendment to Senate Bill 598. It's been rescinded?
Yeah.
Oh, I will. I can do that. Yeah.
Senator Cruz, are you going to make that part of your motion?
When we get to the bill, after we've done the amendment.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Okay, we do have the -4s. Okay, we're that far. Okay, Senator Cruz moves the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 598. Do we have discussion, concerns? Seeing none, they've been moved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 598 as amended, with the removing the subsequent referral to Ways and Means with the approval of the Senate President to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 598 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with removal of the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means with the approval of the President. Discussion. Would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Absent. I'm sorry.
Senator Montanus?
Yes.
Senator Charles Starr?
Votes aye.
Chairman Warren Sapp?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, this is a very good bill. I want to thank Dr. Bates, and I think he should carry it.
Okay. Close the work session. Dr. Bates will carry the bill. Thank you very much. Okay, it is. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 811. Would you describe the bill, please?
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 811 requires the Department of Human Services to give highest priority to a child's permanency plan to prevent the child from remaining in foster care. For an extended period of time, it does direct the department to accomplish this department by beginning permanency planning as soon as the child begins foster care. Thank you, Senator.
Jim Thompson and Joyce Padilla, would you please come up?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Thompson, policy advisor to Senator Gary George and former interim state representative from District 23. I'll keep my introductory remarks very brief. The three bills that are coming up before you all have a common thread. In April of last year, the Interim Joint Health and Human Services Committee heard testimony that our adoption and foster care system had some serious problems. As a result of that meeting, and additional information that was supplied to us by foster parents, Senator George and myself convened a committee to look at problems in House District 23, 24, and Senate District 12. With additional input, the problem was quickly seen to be much larger in scope and encompassed quite a number of counties. We put together a committee that was comprised of Senator George, Senator Bill Fisher, Representative Donna Nelson, Representative Betsy Close, and myself, and Senator Starr sat in on one or two of those hearings. In all, we recorded 13 hours of testimony over several months that led us to the conclusion that the system needed to be repaired and needed some serious reworking. Out of those hearings have come Senate Bill 811, Senate Bill 815, and Senate Bill 813, which has folded in to become 895, which is actually being sponsored by Senator Bruce Starr. These bills are the beginning of an effort to bring about some changes in refining the foster care system. On March 31st, the House Speaker appointed a special subcommittee on child welfare to look at these issues. I'm hoping the Senate might follow suit with that. The importance of these changes that we're requesting is great. First of all, we have a shortage of children's foster care home in some counties, and that shortage, every indication is, it's going to become greater, not less. Secondly, recruiting foster parents is more difficult. There's problems with the way foster parents have been treated, and there's also the consideration of more difficult children coming into the system, which means that there's a lot more specialization required. And thirdly, we came to the conclusion after our hearings that we frankly don't treat our foster parents very well in the state of Oregon, and we needed to address that issue. To Senate Bill 811, this puts into statute the goal that permanency planning begin immediately after placement in foster care, and that it have a very high priority. And you'll hear testimony from Mrs. Padilla that this isn't always the case, and we have numerous examples of where this is applicable. The bill sets a counterbalance to the present practice of restarting the 12-month clock over and over again so that many children stay in foster care for years, in some cases until they're old enough to really not be adoptable, and then they're in foster care for the rest of their young lives. In talking with people from DHS, they've objected to this bill because, according to federal regulations, the highest priority needs to be on child safety. We have no objections to inserting language recognizing the overriding importance of child safety, but at the same time, we think it's important to keep language in there that this is a very, very high priority to get these kids into some kind of permanency planning and demonstrate that effort early on. We also recognize that part of the problem causing a perpetual 12-month clock is that judges grant too many case continuances, but getting permanency planning into statutes may also alleviate that problem. And with that, I'm going to leave the introductory remarks and go to Mr. Padilla, who has firsthand experience with the problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself, please.
Yes. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Joyce Padilla. I'm a foster parent. I reside in Polk County. And I'm here to support SB, Senate Bill 811. And specifically, I'd like to address the amount of time spent that a child spends in foster care. As we all know, the Adoption and Safe Family Act, or the ASFA Act, which is a federal law, stresses that the child's health and safety shall be a paramount concern in determining what is reasonable and consistent with the plan for timely permanent placement for a child. The reasonable effort requirements can be waived entirely in certain circumstances. I do believe that the intent of this law is the expeditious permanency of children. With ASFA came timelines that would expedite children into permanency, understanding that it's not healthy for children to linger in the system growing up in foster care. I do not believe it is the intent of ASFA to jeopardize the health and safety of children in exchange for reasonable efforts and expeditious permanency. The health and safety of the child seems to be the priority of the agency when removing a child from their home, but once removed, emphasis seems to shift to reasonable efforts, that is, offering timely and intensive services to the parent. I believe there's some questions that we need to ask ourselves, and I pose to the committee today. We need to ask, why are these children entering foster care to begin with? What percent is due to neglect? What percent is due to abuse? And what percent is due to drugs? And of that percentage of neglect and abuse cases, what percent is due to drugs? Specifically, what percent is due to meth and meth-like drugs? What percentage of children removed due to parental meth addictions are returned home? And of this percent of children that are returned home, what percent reenters the care? What percentage repeat this pattern more than once? How many months does it take a child to reenter care? I believe with our technology today, these statistics are being gathered, or should be being gathered, and perhaps it would do us well to look at them. Why are we returning children to drug-addicted parents and calling it expeditious permanency for children? There's nothing permanent about this. Children are being removed. Many times they are coming into care as infants and toddlers because of a parent's long-term drug use, and then they are being returned, removed again, and in many cases returned again and again until 7 or 8 years has elapsed in this child's life. Based on the reasonable efforts wording within ASFA, the agency offers services to the parents not only initially but repeatedly. The timeline restraints within ASFA state that 12 months after jurisdiction or 14 months from placement, a permanency hearing must be held. I believe the purpose of such time restraints is so that the child does not linger in foster care. By allowing the 12-14 months to start over and over, expeditious permanency is not being achieved. Neither is the health and safety of the child being secured. On the contrary, the safety of the child is being sacrificed, as it is neither safe nor healthy to return a child to a parent that has long-standing drug and alcohol addictions and many times mental health issues as well, as they seem to go hand in hand. I believe one possible solution would be to consider meth use and drugs similar to meth use as an aggravated circumstance, freeing the agency from having to make reasonable efforts to reunify the child with the parent. I believe another solution possibly would be to stop the perpetual clock, the 12 months repeating itself over and over. Stop restarting the clock as time is running out for these children. Every child needs to feel secure, and security and permanency go hand in hand. If it is neither healthy nor safe to leave these children in limbo, or worse yet, to be putting them back and forth and back and forth, placing them in care and then out of care. We need to bring permanency to these children. And thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And there may be some questions later, because we do have some agency people, I believe. Why don't you go ahead and step down for just a minute, and we'll come back. Timothy Travis and Kevin George. Timothy, did you sign up for this?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, okay. You're making faces, so I figured you must have. You did sign up for one of the others.
I did, Mr. Chair. Timothy Travis with the Oregon Judicial Department. The ASFA and Oregon law are very clear that the 12-month clock never stops. So the testimony that the clock starts and stops, it doesn't. The permanency hearing is held if the child is in care 12 months after jurisdiction is established or 14 months after the child comes into care. It doesn't stop. The only time that it does stop is if the child is returned home and the case is completely closed, and then it's reopened again. Then the clock starts and stops. But within the context of a case, just because a kid goes home doesn't mean that the clock stops. We're going to have that permanency hearing at 12 months or 14 months as long as the child is still in care.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Thank you.
That's all I wanted to say.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Kevin George. I am the foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services. I'm here to provide you just a brief moment of information concerning Senate Bill 811. And I think Mr. Travis actually addressed most of it for me at this point. It is important that every child deserves and needs and deserves safe, nurturing, permanent families. And foster care is a temporary placement for children. They're not to be growing up in foster care. Prior to this bill moving forward, it would behoove us as a state to make sure that it is in line with federal statutes. And as the previous speaker talked about, it does coincide with the Adoption Safe Family Act that was passed in 1997. And the law does state that the safety of children is the paramount concern that must guide all child welfare practices. The new law requires the child's safety be the paramount concern when making service provisions, placement, and permanent planning decisions, and it's Public Law 105-89. It'll be important for us to make sure we're in compliance with the federal law if this moves forward, and we'd be happy to continue to work with Senator George's office to make appropriate accommodations in compliance with the federal law.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. There may be some questions. Senator George, are you still here? Oh. Jim, did you want to respond to any of this, or should we?
Actually, I think there are foster parents here who have experience.
Well, okay. I guess I'm interested in, is there a compliance problem?
If we identify in the Senate bill that talks about the department shall give the highest priority to child's permanency plan, I believe it will be in conflict if our paramount concern from a federal legislation is safety. It's important. Wording is very important. Many words have been used up here, may have been words here in this committee, but I can tell you quite frankly, they mean a whole lot when we get to juvenile court around reasonable efforts, timelines, permanency, highest priority, primary concern. It would be important that we line these statutes up together if we are going to even pass this.
Is that possible? I mean, are we... I'm trying to decide at what point. I don't want to pass something unless we understand that it's a doable thing. I mean, if we move this bill forward to the floor, we might have some arguments about whether or not it meets the federal law, and I'd like to know that before we...
certainly Chair Morissette, I believe there will be some conflicts at that point in time. We had, we being DHS, had worked with Senator George and had a conversation with his office on a couple of these bills here. This one, we did have a preliminary conversation. Quite frankly, I don't think we spent a lot of time talking about it. And so I was somewhat surprised, which is part of the reason why I don't have written testimony today, that we're going to discuss it today.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Stark.
The federal law says safety is the paramount. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Correct.
The introduction there on line 7 of page 2 specifies that to ensure the child's safety. That permanency is a part of that. And I would think that that pretty well answers the question about safety.
Do you have a copy of the bill?
I do have a copy of the bill, yes.
Well, section 4, to ensure the child's safety and permanence, the department shall give the highest priority to the child's permanency plan to preventing the child from returning to the foster and so on and so forth. Okay.
Correct. Chair Morissette and Senator Starr, I think it is... Part of my point is it is semantics in many ways around what does this word actually mean, and it's one where I think we do need to have legal counsel clearly draw the linkages and tie it together if we decide that this is something that needs to be moved forward so we don't get caught in that.
Okay. First of all, I think this is a good bill, and I would like to move the bill, but I want to be sure that we're... Senator George, would you come up, please? We're ready for you.
Oh, you are. Okay.
We're on 811.
Are you doing long?
No, we're just doing 811.
All right.
The question of the permanency and safety, and it's I agree it might be a semantic thing that we're looking at. But again, we want to... Okay, could you, for the benefit of Senator George, mention one more time what your concern is?
Chair Morissette, the primary concern of the bill that we have at the department is that safety, by the federal legislation, safety is the paramount concern that must guide child welfare services. And what we were chatting about, or discussing, I guess, would be more than chatting, we were discussing was the notion of language is very important when we get to juvenile court around reasonable efforts, around permanency, about how long children stay in care. And it needs... my recommendation is that we continue to work towards this bill of tying it together so that there is no conflict with federal legislation around safety being primary or paramount concern for children.
Okay, let me ask... I'm sorry, just one other question. Do you see anything inherently wrong with this bill? Is there a problem with the bill itself? I mean, the intent of the bill is what I'm asking.
No, I do not.
Okay. So your concern is the wording and to make sure that it's okay. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, State Senator Gary George representing District 12, which is from Gaston, Oregon to Monroe and other areas along the way. Good to be with you here today, and I wish I could say that it's been a positive experience working with the agency on this. As you heard from Representative Thompson, former Representative Thompson, now who's in my office, the whole process and what we went through and the hearings that we've had, many of you have actually maybe even seen those on cable access or saw them being circulated in the building because we filmed them all. But one of the things that continued to come up was this idea of dealing with this issue of permanency, and I noticed when the description of what the federal law includes, it does include timely and permanent placement. So, I mean, this is reasonable to assume that. One of the things that I'll probably bring forward to you in a minute was an article that you may have seen on the floor in the Capitol Clips today talking about how we are failing these children. Now, my search, my effort relative to this issue began in 1997, mainly worried about the protection of the parents of the children, and we began, as we more and more began to look at the process, we realized that we were failing the children as a state. Mm-hmm. And I'm haunted by the young man who had been taken from his home as a child because of drug addiction in his family and had been in our system, and he was about 21 years old when he testified before my committee about 5 or 6 years ago. And he said, "Senator George, the worst parent in the state of Oregon is the state of Oregon." Now, what we're hoping to do here is to send a message that we're going to change this system. And we've been waiting for the agency to do that. We've been waiting for them, you know, to empower, to enable our foster parents to set up a process in which we know, if we know for a fact that that child should not be placed back in an unfit home, that we move them to permanency. So I think the message we need to send with a bill is that we expect that to be a major portion of not only timeliness, but also permanency.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Your message will... Does this wording significantly change what the state is doing right now? Does it change the emphasis?
Probably better off to ask here, and then I'll respond.
Senator Moore said, "I'm actually a little stymied on the question. One of the things I often look for in bills and new bills is this going to add value to the system? Is this going to make a significant change?" I think it's a parallel of many other things in other statutes that talk about permanency. And as Mr. Travis got up and spoke about, you know, 12 months and how fast we need to move towards kids and permanency, and the clock doesn't stop, whatnot. So from my perspective, I'm not sure that it actually does. Would be a significant change.
Does it send a message then? Is that what okay, there sometimes the wording of a bill may not change the intent, but it will send a message. It emphasizes something that maybe has been neglected according to the authors of the bill. I mean, does it do harm?
In your opinion? In my opinion, at this point in time, it does harm just from the standpoint that it doesn't tie rules and statutes from federal to state together. And that's where the conflict is going to be. And oftentimes then we have laws that tell us two different things at the same time.
I want to try to coordinate or, you know, work so that is not a problem, because I don't want to create a conflict or perceived conflict between the state and federal rules. And are you willing to work on that?
Absolutely.
We will come back with the bill.
Absolutely. We've been asking to do that since last summer.
Very good. Then good. We'll do that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we will then close the public hearing on this, and we will bring the bill back. Thank you. Close the public hearing. Okay. Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 815, and go ahead and describe the bill, and we will bring up a couple of panels here.
Thank you, Senator. And I will briefly just describe the Dash 2 amendments, which are in your packet, which basically replaces the bill as well. But the bill does require the Department of Human Services to ensure rights for foster children, and it does list out a number of expectations, including proper treatment, training, agency support, financial support. These are all for foster parents. Information about the child being placed, information on meetings with Department of Human Services, court decisions, education for foster families. It does require DHS to adopt rules to give meaningful grievance procedures to allow foster parents who believe DHS has violated provisions of this act, and that ensures a timely response to appeals. The Dash 2 amendments does establish that foster parents can be treated with dignity and respect, and then does include a number of tenets, including receiving support, receiving information about a foster child, be informed about policies, be allowed to initiate, foster parents being allowed to initiate an inactive status for 12 months, and this and other, and it includes current foster parents and juvenile court proceedings involving the jurisdiction of a child. Thanks, Senator.
Thank you. Jim Thompson, Joyce Padilla, and I'm sorry, we're down here. Jim Thompson, Don Darland, and Terry Fennell, would you please come up? So we have to do this.
He can't go and talk about the original bill that we took.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Jim Thompson. I'm a policy advisor for State Senator Gary George. Senate Bill 815, if you've got the, you did get the original bill, is a modification of a much longer bill. The original bill came from gleaning information from bills of rights for other states that have adopted similar legislation. In conference with DHS and officials from the Foster Parent Association, we held back many of the provisions that DHS felt could be addressed in administrative rules, so therefore you have a shorter bill before you. We watered the bill down as much as possible to recognize concerns that DHS had about putting some things in the statute that might be better done in administrative rules. Unfortunately, the most important element of the bill to us is in contention yet with DHS, that being giving foster parents equal standing in court proceedings with the caseworker, the state attorney, and the court-appointed special advocate. The reason for requesting this provision is twofold. First of all, oftentimes in court proceedings, there is no CASA and no attorney present. The only advocate for the child is the caseworker. Second, the people who know the child best are generally the foster parents. We have an expectation that caseworkers in foster child cases are highly trained and professional. In fact, in Oregon, we have very high turnover in those positions, and many of them are brand new to the system. And this is, you don't just read the book on how to do this. It takes a long experience curve to get up and running. We feel foster parents have already been there, done that, many of them for more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. They need that expertise recognized. You know, an example that I sat through in Polk County dealing with the final adoption order for a child. I was there with the foster parents, and for the hearing before the judge, the CASA was not present, and there was no attorney. The caseworker had been on the case for 3 days. The judge started asking questions, in this case, about why it was an out-of-state adoption. She couldn't answer those questions. The foster parents sitting beside me could have very well answered it. They knew the whole display. They were not afforded the opportunity before the court to intervene. If we are to get positive changes in the foster care system, it's imperative that foster parents have a voice in the planning process. We are told that there is an existing route whereby foster parents can be heard in court, but this has been interpreted at the discretion of the court, and DHS has been ineffective in promoting a voice for foster parents. I believe most foster parents are totally unaware that there is a route by which they can do this, and it is questionable in my mind as whether or not that route is really as free and open as some people might think. This one element is very very important to many foster parents, particularly those who have had the child in their home for years. Additionally, I would like to ask the committee to take note that a number of provisions were removed from this bill in deference to DHS. If these provisions are not addressed in administrative rules, we'll be back next session to strengthen this particular bill, because we think a foster parent's bill of rights is paramount to getting the changes that we think are needed in the system. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Terry?
Chair Morissette, I am members of the committee. I'm Terry Fennell. I'm a foster parent here in Marion County. I'm also the vice president of the Marion Polk Foster Parent Association, and I also serve on the committee at the Oregon Foster Parent Association on that board, on a committee to present this bill.
Okay.
I've been a foster parent for almost 20 years here in Oregon. I've served, my wife and I, we have served about 700 teenagers in our home over that time. And we obviously are very interested in having this bill, you know, passed. I'd like to thank Kevin George for all of his work on this bill. I know that we have been involved with several committee meetings with him, and I know that he has felt that a foster parent bill of rights would be an important retention tool for foster parents in the state, because at this point we obviously have a severe crisis in that area, and it would be important for us to have that, we believe. One of the tenets I would like to also make note of that I think is very important that we have access to is tenet number 4, which is the one that provides us written information, including things like the psychological and the discharge reports that we may get. I think that the foster parents need to have every tool in their tool chest that they can possibly have to help support the children that are in their home. I think, as was discussed in the earlier bill, safety is paramount in my home. And if I'm going to take a new child into my home and I don't know what that child could potentially cause problems or be a safety concern to those that are already in my home, I feel that I need to have that information as much as possible. And one of the reasons I think it needs to be written is because once a child moves into my home, then at that point, things, you know, I then start to pick up on all the different things with that child, and then I need to revisit sometimes that written information to see what was going on before and how I can best serve the needs of that child. Over the years, we've spent quite a bit of time as a shelter home, meaning we take kids from one day, maybe over a weekend. During the time when we were doing that, we have had 3 young people who have, you know, some years later gone on to commit murders. 3 of those people lived in my home. If they were going to be in my home on a long-term basis, I certainly feel that I would like to have as much information as possible to be able to protect the others in my home. And so I think that tenet is extremely important. I'd also like to... Yes.
I'm sorry. What's lacking at the present time as far as the information? That's an interesting question. How old were the people or were the children when you took them?
They were 15, 16, 17.
Okay. So there was a history then with these children that you didn't know about.
That's correct.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I also want to address the ability to be a party to the case. I think that's also important because, again, in many instances, the foster parents have been involved with the children for a period of time, and we may have the most information that we can provide to the court. Mm-hmm. We also do not have some of the restraints that I think others may have. I mean, in terms of we speak primarily to the child's best interest, and sometimes that doesn't happen because of other commitments that other folks may have, and I think that we try to speak to the children's best, put them as the highest priority.
Now, I'm going to interrupt one more time because I should have asked another question. I'm going to have to find out what the process is for providing information. Now, I'm sure there must have been some background that you received. No. I see head shaking. So what you're saying is there is an adequate background. Let me rephrase it. What about the due diligence that a foster parent should make before they take a child into their home? I mean, what part of the responsibility is your responsibility, and what part is the people who put... Does the state come and ask you to take a foster child, or do you... Okay, they do. And I'm just trying to establish who has the major responsibility. I think that the person who received the child certainly has to ask questions, and I'm sure you've learned that you need to ask.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. Part of the challenge that I'm concerned with in regard to that is the fact that I may ask the right questions, But sometimes there's more information that would add to, if I don't ask the right question on every single question, I may not have all the things that I need. I do have, I have a substantial list of questions that I ask whenever a child is to be placed. I don't think every foster parent has followed up in, as well on
well,
that.
Well, let me rephrase the question then. My question is that I'm not saying that the state would withhold information. Are you saying they would withhold information? And
there have been times in the past where they have withheld information.
And if you don't write the if you don't ask the right question, you're not going to be told the information that
Is correct.
That you should have.
Can I give you a quick example?
Go ahead.
I had a 4-year old, when my daughter was 4 years old. I happened to be talking to a foster parent with regard to a child that she would call because she was having a boy removed from her home, a teenager. He was being removed because he had sexually abused her 4-year-old daughter. An hour after I had that conversation, I received a call from the agency asking to place a child in my home. As I gathered information, it sounded an awful lot like this young man. When I asked specifically if it was that young man, the response was, yes, it is. And I said, well, why didn't you tell me about this information? And the response was, oh, he's not been adjudicated. Now, he had done the deed, but he hadn't been adjudicated, and so at that point, that particular worker had decided not to share that information with me.
Thank you. Continue.
I think it's also important that we do be a party to the case, as I started to say, because it is, again, we are the ones that have the most information. We spend 24/7 with these people, with these children, and we obviously get very attached to them, and I think that we can be their best advocate. I thank you for your opportunity to testify, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
Thank you.
Chair Morissette and the members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Don Darland. I'm the president of the Oregon Foster Parent Association. I reside in Linn County. And I'm just going to make my comments real brief. Been a consulting foster parent for about 12 plus years. That's helping foster parents deal through challenges and difficulties through the agency locally or at the state level. Privilege of sitting on numerous committees and task force, and actually enjoy a very good working relationship with the department. A couple facts that we really need to consider. One, if there's no foster parents, there really is no child protective services here in the state. So I think we need to keep that far in front of us, because neither the judge or the caseworker is going to be taking the child home. And so we need to remember that. And the other thing is, by virtue of living with the kids, you know, we've already heard some of that, we really know and understand these kids best. I'm in favor of the proposed amendment -2. In part, I was disappointed to see that the section 2 in the original bill, the grievance procedure, was left off. That was actually an accident, because I truly think that we do need a meaningful way to resolve conflict. So I don't know how that gets done. Maybe we can do that in the House side or something, but that would be good to have the original Section 2 be put in as Section 3, if that's possible. Now, every one of these rights, the one thing that I want to bring forward too is every one of these rights has an equal responsibility. And so as president of OFPA, I plan on ensuring that the foster parents are trained and they understand those responsibilities, because those are critical. We can't just say we have rights without stepping up to the plate and saying, okay, well, we do have a responsibility. And Senator Morissette, you already spoke to that very well, that we do have a responsibility to protect our home. And I believe that this foundation, if we have a foundation of basic rights, that we can then build to create some healthy relationships. And as you see on my written testimony, my mantra is rules without relationships lead to rebellion. So we got to have relationships, and this is a basic foundation for that. And if any time relationships in conflict, we can come back to this foundation, and it's a guide to get back to a positive solution. So I thank you very much for your time, and appreciate, if possible, to move this bill forward. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Tell me about the reason that the grievance procedure was left out.
I believe that was a total mistake.
I think it happened in the rewriting in Legislative Council. We just discovered it as we walked in the room here today. It was not intended to be left out, and talking with DHS, they're willing to work on a grievance procedure.
Okay.
So it just didn't show up on the paper.
Now, tell me, before we talk to DHS, what you did to accommodate DHS. In
if you have the original bill, it spells out a whole lot of issues, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, on there. About 20 of those were taken off. And we're going to be working with DHS to look at those through adoption of administrative rules. I have no reason to believe that won't be a successful way to do it. So this bill becomes more general, less specific, and the thought was we could deal with specifics in administrative rules. At least that's my recollection of the discussion. And we have no problem with that. If that doesn't happen, we'll be back in 2 years to put them back in. So, but DHS has worked with us in good faith so far. I don't have any questions about that we could do that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Question? Thank you.
Okay. Joyce Padilla, Shelley Hudson, and Gary Ledgerwood. And then Senator Gary George, you're the cleanup hitter. Oh, I'm sorry. And then we have others. Timothy, okay. Yeah, we have two lists up here, and so we have an expanded list that we will deal with also. Who wants to start? Joyce, you've been here before. You go ahead.
All right, thank you. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, as stated before, I'm Joyce Padilla, and I'm a foster parent. And some of what I will talk on today has already been highlighted and hit on with Jim Thompson and Terry Fennell and Don Darlin. As was stated, first of all, I'm here in support of the Foster Parent Bills of Rights, and particularly would like to address the amendment that would grant legal status to foster parents. Presently, we have an Oregon statute that is in place that states that the Department of Human Services shall give foster parents notice of hearings, and the courts shall give the person an opportunity to be heard. Now, according to the Judicial Department, a representative of the Judicial Department, the intent of the law has been that foster parents have the right to address the judge, even though that's not the specific wording, and whether that be in person, in writing, or by telephone. But the intent, I'm told, is that the foster parents do have the right to address the judge. However, intent does not ensure the right. And if the intent of the law is for foster parents to be able to personally address the judge, then I'm here to tell you that that is not happening. That in our county, we have judges that are telling foster parents that only legal parties may address the courts, and that only legal parties may write the judge. And we have judges that are telling us that we may write them, or we can submit evidence, or we can submit something to them, that they do not have to acknowledge what we submit because we are not a legal party, and that if a foster parent wants to be heard, then they must go through the caseworker or the court-appointed special advocate or the CASA. Now, as was stated earlier by the previous panel up here, the problem with that is that there is a CASA shortage. There just are not enough CASAs to go around, so not every child has a CASA worker. And also, there's oftentimes when caseworkers and foster parents may not be in agreement as to case planning. And then caseworkers are not informing the courts that the foster parents are in the courtroom. and they're not asking, if caseworkers are not asking prior to the hearing if we have something to say. And judges certainly in our county are not asking if foster parents are present in the courtroom or if we have anything to add. And I personally make it a point to attend the hearings for the children in my home so that I can stay informed with the case plan and what is happening in the case. And I have yet to be asked by a caseworker or a judge if I have anything to add. And to me, this hardly feels like that we are being given an opportunity to be heard. The Judicial Department has produced a little booklet that goes out to foster parents. It's called A Guide for Foster Parents, and it's regarding the Juvenile Court Improvement Project. And in that, it states, and I'll quote, it says, foster parents are key to the court's ability to ensure safety, permanency, and well-being for Oregon's abused and neglected children. As foster parents, we may have information that will help the courts in making decisions about the dependent child and their care, end of quote. And I really believe this is true, and as was stated previously, the reason for this is that a committed and dedicated foster parent is one that's with the children 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. We're with these children, interacting with them day to day, every day. We stay with the children when caseworkers change. We stay with them. Foster parents bond with the children, and children bond to us as they remain often for lengthy periods of time in our home. And because they are remaining in our homes, we have a chance to build a healthy parent-child relationship with them. When the courts do not give us the opportunity to be heard, then I believe that vital information that could impact the case, possibly change the direction of the case, is being discarded. It's not being heard, it's not being listened to, and it's being discarded. And I think that's to the detriment of these children. Because foster parents, and again, I'd like to emphasize foster parents who are committed and dedicated to caring for these children and nurturing them, because we build a relationship with these children, many of these children come to us, they come to feel safe and secure in our home, and in that security, they're allowed to begin healing physically and emotionally, and they come to a time where they are free to disclose information to us because they feel safe. They begin to open up and disclose information that they won't disclose to anyone else. Because
okay, let me
yes,
interrupt
yes.
this minute. On page 2, do you have the
yes, I do.
On page 2, lines 19 through 21,
yes.
Number 11, be notified of the foster parent's rights to limited participation in proceedings and so on. That's what you're talking about?
Well, not only to be notified, but just to be able to speak. I foster in multiple counties. Yes.
Where is that addressed in here then? I mean, I just got these a little while ago. I don't...
Okay.
Is there a place in here that says you have standing in the courtroom to be recognized as a party in the dispute?
Page 3, line 14, the current foster parent, the child award, is where it actually would be giving us legal standing. On page 3, line 14.
Yeah, the current foster parent of the child or ward.
It's, if you back up, it's talking in section 2. It's line 23 on page 2 where that begins. Okay. And it's listing the legal parties.
Okay, so you are then included.
Yes, which we are not at
and
this point.
And that then gives you standing.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
That's
and
what I was looking for.
Yes.
I'm surprised you don't have standing already.
Well, thank you. I do. But as I was talking, the foster parents, because we do have this relationship that the others also addressed, because these children, these are not normal children. These are children that are coming to care because they've been traumatized, they've been abused, they've been neglected. They've learned that the adults in their life hurt them, and they can't trust them. It takes everything you've got to build trust into that child's life. That these children, because they feel secure and they are being nurtured in a good foster home, they do come to a point where they learn to trust you, and they open up and they begin to share about the atrocities that have happened to them. I have had children who have disclosed to me issues of sexual abuse, that they've been abused in their homes, and taken this to the caseworker and been told that because we're just the foster parent, that, you know, it really doesn't matter, that they told us that unless they tell a legal party, the caseworker or the CASA, in this case these children don't have CASAs, or a doctor, a professional, a doctor, a therapist, then both the children have told me as a foster parent will not stand up in court because I am not a legal party. So I believe because of that, and because these children, it's hard for them to open up and tell the stuff because it hurts. And this is information that often is being discarded. So if we're not a legal party and we don't have a voice, information is being lost, basically, and these children suffer for that. I believe that not only within the courts, but within the agency, it is vital that we be considered a legal party. Okay. Did you have a question? I have that.
No, no. Can you wrap it up, though, because
right.
we...
Okay, yes, I will. Real quickly, within the agency alone, and Terry Fennell was addressing how that the notification issues and also wanting to get the written documentations. The agency does have a partnership pack that they've produced that says that we are to work as a team, but the partnership pack really isn't implemented. We are not team members, and I've set in meetings, and as Terry, I believe, stated, that our interest is that what we have, our focus is the best interest of this child, because we are there to advocate for them. And an example of not being respected for the information we have and not being listened to, real quickly, we had a case where we had a 3-year relationship with the biological parent because child had come into our home in foster care, out of our home. Because we had built a relationship with the biologic parent, remained in that parent's life when the child was returned home, did offer daycare for her. The child came back into foster care, back into our home, and the caseworkers, this child had repeated caseworkers. The caseworker was new to this case, did not know this parent, did not know the history. And we were in a meeting where the plan at that point, we were informed, was that mom had just been released from being incarcerated. We were told that this was the second time the child had come into care. And we were told that the plan would be at this point that, and mom had just come out of jail for 3 months, that the child was going to go immediately into unsupervised visits with this parent, and that they did not need to do supervised visits, and that the plan was that they would go directly to unsupervised visits because mom had already done those like 2 years ago, and so they didn't need to do that again. Because we knew this mother, we sat in that meeting with her, and she also had mental health issues. We knew she was not stable at, even within the meeting, and we argued the health and safety issues.
We're going to have to move along because we do have quite a few people.
I'll just wrap it real quickly then. Basically, we were speaking out for the health and safety or the best interest of this child. We were told that that didn't matter. The child was going to go home. This was the plan. And if the child had not had a CASA present in the room, there would have been nothing we could have done. Because we're not a legal party, we couldn't have asked for a special hearing. In this case, the CASA did ask for a special hearing, and and that could happen.
We do support the bill. We're going to move it, so keep it short. Don't talk us out of it.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Don't say anything that discourages us because we want to move it.
Right, okay. Basically, then, to wrap it up, I would just say that foster parents are... Don mentioned that with legal status and rights comes responsibility, and I agree with that. I believe that a dedicated, committed foster parent is already carrying that a high level of responsibility without the legal status. And so we are bearing the responsibility without a voice, and I'm asking for a voice to go with that responsibility.
Very briefly.
Chair Morissette and committee members, my name is Shelby Hudson, and I'm a foster parent, and I'm also on the board of the Oregon State Foster Parents Association as a regional representative. And mine's going to be real short here because I've had basically nothing, but I have been included in the different court hearings. I have been able to speak. In fact, I have not been to any court hearing where I haven't been able to speak, but I know that it's out there, and what I'm asking for is a consistency throughout the state where this is going to be happening and not just in cases like for me and my husband, because we have not had any problem like I'm hearing here. And we've been very thrilled with that. They've listened to us, and we've seen a lot of growth in our youth from our home because of that cohesiveness of the team member. But we need to be equal partners on the same team. And that's just because we are with the kids 24/7, and we do know as much, if not more, about the kids. So I think that our input should be included, valued, and respected, and because we are an integral part of the team, and the safety and the service to the youth and the youth needs, they've got to come first. And as professional foster parents, we recognize the importance of the confidentiality concerning the documents that we need to assess, like the psychological evaluations and medical records and stuff like that. So we're not taking this lightly, like, you know, it's just a piece of paper and letting it lay around or anything. We do realize, you know, how important these papers are and that we can be trusted with them. And it will help, you know, in the future files. And I just have always been very blessed with, all except for one instance, I have had access to all the information, and it has made a humongous difference. Mm-hmm. And so I can compare the two, and if for us to do the job that we need to do to have the safety in place for our youth and ourselves, we need to have access to that. And I thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'm finished.
I'll be very, 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 very short, gentlemen. My name is Gary Ledgewood, Chairman Morissette and Chairman Peeple. I'm a foster parent, been one for 16 years. I'm current president of the Marion Polk County Foster Parent Association. I support both of these ladies' thoughts about being consistent in court, being allowed to be representative of our kids in court. My wife and I are very assertive, so sometimes, most of the time, we get to speak for our kids, but there are caseworkers sometimes who don't want us to speak, and we have to sometimes, almost in front of the judge, be more assertive than usual to get the opportunity to speak for our children. But we used to get that chance because I'm a very assertive person in court. But not all foster parents are that way. I do support, as been said before, Section 1. I'd like to see us as foster parents be treated with more respect, be allowed to have more decision-making with the kids that we're involved with, and be treated more as team players. And I'm also very involved in really interested in Section 4 about access to psychological, especially psychological evaluations. That's so important that we as foster parents, again, being treated as professionals, be allowed access to important material that will help us with the child, help us to keep that child safe and keep the other children in our home safe, so that all of us are in a very conducive environment, and where the kids need, where the child's needs are put foremost, and we're able to work as professionals with that child's needs. We have had a couple of instances in the 15 and 16 years I've been a foster parent where we didn't get the information we needed, maybe that child didn't belong in our home because of that child's problems, or that we could have helped that child more had we gotten that information sooner. And so I think it's very important Section 4 be allowed to go through, especially this bill. In fact, this whole bill should be passed because it's important that we, number one, be allowed to be treated as professionals, number two, treat our kids the way they need to be treated, allow them to be safe and secure in our home by letting us have the information we need to take care of these kids. Folks, I thank you very much for the time, and I'm open to any questions you'd have to give me.
Well, we'll move ahead, and if there are questions, we'll come back to you. We have two other related bills that we'd like to get to, and I don't know that we're going to go before. You have to be out of here.
Five.
Oh, wow. So we may lose our majority here in that. Timothy Travis. And, Kevin George.
I'm Timothy Travis. I'm the Court Improvement Manager for the State of Oregon for the Judicial Department. And I wanted to just start by reminding the members of this panel that I represented abuse and neglected children in Multnomah County Juvenile Court for about 8 years. I have probably been in more foster homes than anyone in this room, except perhaps for Mr. Darlin. I made it a regular part of my representation of children to visit them in their foster homes and to talk in depth with their foster parents. Everything these foster parents have said today about them being the primary source, the best source of information about their children, is absolutely correct. I never met a foster parent that didn't have a stack of spiral notebooks this thick in which they daily made notes about the health and well-being of their children, and they were a fantastic and invaluable source of information. I also want to say that foster parents are the third leg of the volunteer stool that helps improve our system. Not many people realize that foster parents are volunteers. They are not paid for what they do. The money they get is paid to them for the support of the children in their care. In fact, I have met very few foster parents who do not subsidize these children out of their own pockets. So when people start talking about foster parents are in it for the money and stuff like that, that is absolutely and positively false. I want to talk a little bit about the handouts that I've given you. The large one, this right here, this is the executive summary of the Juvenile Court Improvement Project's recent reassessment of the courts in Oregon. And on page 4 of this executive summary, there is a section that talks about foster parent and or party and foster parent presence at court hearings and CRB reviews. Let me state very unequivocally on this record, there is absolutely no discretion for a judge in Oregon to not hear from a foster parent. What you've heard today about one county is not the law. I heard about this day before yesterday, and let me assure this committee and let me assure these foster parents that I have already begun to straighten that situation out. Foster parents have the right to be heard orally in court under Oregon statute and under federal law. That is being straightened out. If they prefer for some reason to not appear personally and orally testify, if they fear for their safety given the particular circumstances of this case, or if they cannot find child care to enable them to be free to come to court to make that statement, then we will accommodate them by either having them testify by telephone or by receiving written material from them. So it is not necessary for them to be a party to the case. Yes, the performance is uneven, and anybody who wants to give me the name of any judge in Oregon who will not allow them as foster parents to have their right to be heard, I will be pleased to follow up on that, and they will get that right. But let me go back to page 4. On the bottom, in the middle, it says the reassessment recommends. There are two recommendations that my organization is currently working on in this area. And the first is to provide training to foster parents about courtroom culture and the kinds of information that judges want to hear from foster parents, and that we, that's my organization, JSIP, should work with DHS and the Foster Parents Association to ensure that foster parents get that training on a regular basis. Now, that second brochure, that brochure that you received earlier while the other witness was testifying, this was prepared by my office. And if you look at this, you will see unequivocally that foster parents have the right to be heard. And this gives them information about what the court wants to hear from them. So
we are working in this area to not only recognize the importance of foster parents, not just because we're nice people, but because we know that they have the information. They know more about these kids than anybody else involved.
Excuse me, Timothy. Is the statutory language then giving, let's see, it's, I guess it's on page 2, including foster parents' right. What does that do?
Mr. Chair, I haven't been able to see the dash 2, so I don't know. There hasn't been a copy.
Okay.
Oh, which one are we talking about?
Page 2, it adds...
We need to add them as a party to the case?
Yeah.
Let me talk about that a little bit, because the Judicial Department is neutral on this bill.
Yeah.
But let me bring up some things that we may want to consider and whether or not they should be, thank you so much, whether or not they should be a party to the case. First of all, if they have been fostering a child long enough that they have what's called a caregiver relationship, and that means for 12 months, they have the right to intervene and become a party to the case. Okay? So they have that right to intervene, to ask to be made a party, if they've been fostering the child for 12 months. Let's look at what a party to the case is and what a party to the case does. The major concern that we might have, there are two. The first is that as a party to the case, they are entitled to all of the information about all of the parents in the case. It is absolutely imperative that they have the kind of information that they have talked about today, the kind of information that's going to determine whether or not there are safety issues, whether or not the children have needs that they have to meet. That's absolutely fine. There's absolutely no reason, however, for them to have psychological evaluations on siblings of these children that they're not fostering, drug and alcohol information about the parents. That is very heavily confidential information, and there's no reason for a foster parent to have that kind of information. Now, one thing that they have said today is that they are advocates for the children, and it may well be that they are advocates for the children. However, we cannot discount the fact that in some cases there is a conflict of interest between the foster parent and the parent. As a matter of fact, foster parents become attached to these children. They want to keep these children. And it's important to understand that the vast majority of our special needs children are adopted by nobody other than the foster parents. We cannot find adoptive homes for these kids. These foster parents step up to the plate and adopt these children, and that's a wonderful thing. But in some cases, a foster parent's judgment, like everybody else's judgment, as to what the best interest of the child is, can be clouded by their own personal desire to hold on to this particular kid. A foster parent's role currently in the system is as the best witness that we have about the kid. It's up to this body to make the policy determination as to whether or not they want to put the foster parent on an equal legal basis with the biological parent. They can do that if they want to, but that's what we're doing if we make them a party to the case. We're allowing them to make appeals to the Court of Appeals. We're allowing them to appear by counsel. We're giving them the full panoply of rights that everybody else in the case has. It's up to the legislature to determine if they want to do that, but right now, by federal law, what they are is the best witness we have and the best source of permanency for the kids.
Now, are you saying there's a conflict then between the federal law? There would be a conflict?
No, I'm not saying that there would be. What I'm saying is the conflict that I'm talking about is that, yes, they provide wonderful information, but it's possible.
By federal law, they were.
By federal law currently. The adoption and safe families act, 20 years ago, the policy toward foster parents was, you sit out in the hall, we don't want to deal with you, we don't want you to become attached to these children. In fact, when we think you're becoming attached to these children, we're going to move these children because foster care is not a backdoor to adoption. That used to be the policy. But when the Adoption and Safe Families Act passed, we changed that policy, recognizing what I said earlier, that they're the best witnesses we have and that they very frequently provide the only permanency these kids will ever have. So we went from go away to come on down. And that's where the right to be heard in court came from and this other kind of stuff that we're talking about. We're in the midst right now, in many areas in child protection, we lose sight of the fact we're in the midst of a sea change right now. We're halfway sort of through retrofitting an airplane in midair. We're going from policies of child protection that predated this sea of alcohol and drugs that we're involved in to a new system that recognizes the situation we're currently in. And that's one of the reasons that the system creaks the way it does. It's because it used to be that poverty and ignorance were the basis of what we were working with. Now it's poverty, ignorance, and substance abuse. And that's why the system sometimes, we're trying to refit ourselves as we go along. And the same is true with foster parents. We are transferring from this go wait until we're done deciding to this come on down policy.
Question? Okay.
If you have, I could talk all day, you know that. So if you have any questions, ask. Otherwise, I'll be quiet.
Timothy and I have a relationship that goes back many years, and so when I said, I know you can talk all day, that because...
He can. He speaks from authority.
Yes.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Kevin George, for the record, and my position is the foster care program manager over the Department of Human Services. I'm actually here today with an extremely heavy heart that we're even here talking about needing to have a Bill of Rights for foster parents. And it's conversations that Don Darlin and I have had a number of times around why do we even get to this point of needing to have legislation that says people be treated fairly and respectfully. With that aside, we have worked with Senator George's office, and I did receive the proposed amendment -2 yesterday afternoon. Unfortunately, I have been unable to do a full analysis on it and look have our attorney generals actually look at it for all the implications as well. But I do want to point out a couple of things of areas of question in the amendment 2 that came up. One is that there is already rules around and statute around being able to provide information to foster parents. And it's very clear from hearing today's testimony from foster parents as well as other conversations I've had with foster parents that it is not clear to our caseworkers what those laws, what those rules mean, and so how do we change that practice. So that is very clear and understandable to my point that they need to have that information, and caseworkers need to know what they can release and how to go about doing that to foster parents. The other piece that it was...
You're talking the confidentiality...
Correct. It's the Section 4 that was pointed out around access to information.
Yeah. Okay. So,
the other piece that was left off, and I would encourage the committee to make sure that we actually get it put back in there, was what Don Darlin spoke to about the grievance procedure piece. That is important to have in there. The Section 2 area was fairly new to me yesterday afternoon around party status, and Mr. Travis has spoken to most of the areas of concern that I had around current Oregon administrative rules, current Oregon statutes, federal regulations about the opportunity to be heard. There's also the piece about the intervener status. Mm-hmm. The fact is that I hear from these foster parents today the desire to have that right. I would be hard-pressed to say that I believe that would be shared amongst foster parents across the state because, as they've noted, party status brings responsibility. And to have the ability then to look at having to go to all the hearings, discovery materials, rights to appeal, without, and they're having without legal representation, do the vast majority of foster parents want that? So if it was the will of this committee to decide that, no, we want to have foster parents to have party status, I would encourage folks to look at putting some level of an ability to obtain that if necessary, but not make it a blanket party status across the board, because I would believe a lot of our foster parents would not want that. We have situations where we have foster parents who do not want us to disclose their name, their whereabouts, of who they are to the biological families, and bringing them into party status is going to be more difficult for us to implement that statute that we passed last session to keep their information confidential. I think the fact is that the opportunity to be heard, the court shall hear them. I think it's one where we have to continue to make sure the courts and the caseworkers clearly know what their roles and responsibilities are, to have foster parents' voices heard, understood, and respected. And that's my testimony for today. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Senator George, would you come up, please?
Sure.
Increasing the assessment.
The issue after, for the record again, Senator, State Senator Gary George, District 12. For the foster parent who's had the child for 12 months, isn't it correct that it isn't just they walk in and they have that right to participate in this process, but they actually have to apply to the court to get that?
Timothy Travis, Court Improvement Project. Absolutely. That's absolutely correct. There's a procedure by which a foster parent files a motion to become an intervener in the case, yes.
Okay. Thanks very much. If I had my druthers, Mr. Chairman, and I can leave this bill, I'd leave this building with only one bill, it would be the original bill. Okay. Because this is language that exists in other states that provide protection for these foster parents. And after we sat through those hearings, if I was a Catholic and I could do this, I would ordain them all the saints for what they do. It's amazing what they put up with. Mm-hmm. And it's really, to me, almost immoral that they do not have the support, you know, from the agency. The department is not giving them the respect and the right to participate as they should have. The grievance, according to our notes, the idea of the grievance being removed was, in fact, from DHS. We're very pleased to have them on record stating that they want that entered back into the bill, because I think that grievance procedure is going to give a little bit of equality here in the negotiations. As you just heard from the gentleman that was up here with me, these folks do an amazing job. They keep records. They have attachment to these children that's just unappreciated. And if I'm going to be quiet right now, Mr. Chairman, because I see you have a committee and you want to move a bill. But this is, if I was going to say there was a priority bill for me, this would be it, because I don't think anything is more important with the needs we have for additional foster parents, not to establish clearly right off the bat that they're going to be treated with respect. And I thank you very much for hearing the bills. Okay. Happy to answer any questions.
Interesting. Okay, why don't you step down?
Okay.
Timothy Travis, would you come back up, please? And Kevin George. Okay, we have a lot of different things flying around because Senator George just said he'd rather have the original bill than the amendments.
No, if I had my...
Okay.
You brought forward
the dash twos. Okay, let's stay with the dash twos. Does this do harm to the system, in your opinion? The dash twos, are these, do these raise what you consider to be problems? Okay. I guess you raise a question of not all parents want to have that status, and so that would be one situation, I guess, that you would want to address to not make it a blanket, or you would make it an opt-in, or what? How would you deal with that?
As
to distinguish between parents and not say all people. Seems to me it's an automatic opt-in if they have the ability but choose not to take that ability. Isn't that an automatic opt-in?
Right. Senator Morissette, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Kevin George at the Department of Human Services. This is the piece of the legal standing that I need more counsel from our Attorney General's office on as far as that whole status. I believe it raises many issues when we start blanket covering folks in as party status and would need to know about what is their constitutional rights around that, because again, as they've mentioned, with rights brings responsibilities, and where do they begin and end? I think it's also important. So that's what my statement would be.
Okay. Until two sessions ago, grandparents were automatically parties to juvenile court cases, but because of the Troxell v. Granville case in the Supreme Court of the United States.
Can you move the microphone a little bit closer?
Because of the Troxell v. Granville case in the Supreme Court of the United States, which had to do with third-party custody and visitation cases, where you had third parties and biological parents competing in a case for visitation and custody, we were forced to remove grandparents as automatic
parties to a juvenile court case, and we had to put them down to where if they wanted to come and participate, they would come and participate on the very same status as foster parents currently do. They would be invited to come, and they would be heard. Because of the constitutional issue, when you have competing interests between biological parents and third parties, I'm not prepared to say today that it's unconstitutional to automatically make an unrelated third party who is a foster parent a party. I know that if that foster parent qualifies as an intervener, then that meets the test of the Supreme Court in Troxell v. Granville that gives them party status. It's important to understand that a party to the case is someone who has a legal interest to protect. It's not just someone, unless they're a representative of the child, like an attorney or a CASA, it's not just someone who has their best interest at heart. It's someone who has a legal interest to protect. And when an intervener has a caregiver relationship with a child, as that is spelled out in the statute, that is a legal interest for them to protect. And whether 12 months is the right period of time for a foster parent to gain that legal interest is a policy question for this body. It used to be 18 months. It was lowered to 12 at one point.
Okay. I'm sorry for interrupting.
That's fine.
But you're saying that they do achieve that after 12 months?
After 12 months, they're eligible to achieve that. Yes. If a person is not a foster parent and they meet the criteria of ORS 419B116, which is the caregiver statute, and you may recognize that as psychological parent, they can become a psychological parent sooner than a foster parent can.
So a foster parent during the first 12 months under existing statute does not have, he's not, that person is not a legal intervener?
That person does not qualify to become a legal intervener, no.
And a legal intervener's rights include, or obligations are?
A legal intervener is a full party to the case.
Well, it's true.
That means they can call witnesses, they get notice, they can appeal, they can do anything that a parent can do, except they're not eligible for court-appointed counsel.
This statute then would provide that right of a legal intervener immediately upon becoming a foster parent?
That's correct, and it would remove that status if the child was removed from their home, because it says the current caretaker.
So while the child was in their home, they would have that.
That's right.
Okay, is there a problem?
I'm not prepared to say today for certain, but there is the thing about the grandparents having been removed from that status.
Just a second. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at is if we move this bill out as written with the dash twos, what harm is done? What problem arises? There, you're saying there could be some legal interpretations that you're not sure of.
Right. Senator Cruz was around when this all happened, and he recalls he's been very concerned about the grandparent rights for a long time.
Okay. Do you think I ought to call on?
Hmm? Senator Cruz, at your own peril, and I'm not sure, Timothy, where this weighs in there. I had another question,
yeah,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead and do the other question.
And it was basically this gives them the status, but they, and I understand your question, some would not want to be put in that position, but because they have the status doesn't mean they have to appear. It's not like, you know, if they chose not to participate, they could choose not to participate. As the way it is now, when both parents might have, they clearly have legal status, and one for whatever reasons may choose not to participate. And so, you know, they're still that opt out on their own discretion. Wouldn't that be correct?
Chair Cruz, yes, that would be correct. Someone can choose not to participate. From my perspective, nevertheless, they would still be a full party and still be getting all the discovery documents and whatnot that Mr. Travis spoke about earlier.
That I guess, is the other thing that I want to ask about is all of the... Now you're, Tim, one of you are saying, maybe both of you are saying that there is confidential information there that you feel that as a foster parent, at least, now let me again differentiate, after the first year they would be eligible to have access to that discovery document, is that what?
If they show that they have that legal interest to protect, yes, absolutely. Okay. They get all that information.
So, and that seemed to be a concern, that there are things that they, that are, you consider, privacy issues that they shouldn't have access to until they reach that point.
That's correct.
So tell me again, you lowered it from 18 months to 12 months.
You did that.
I'm sorry.
I didn't do it. I favored it, but I didn't do it.
The legislature lowered it from 18 months to 12 months.
Correct.
Senator George, would you please come back up here if you can make it expeditiously? And Senator George, you feel that that's information that should be available to the foster parent immediately? There's no need to wait for a year before they should have that full right of an intervener when they take the child into their home?
I scribbled some notes here relative to, you know, we have court-appointed special advocates, and probably some of them with less training than our foster parents. Exposed, have the ability, if you look up on line 4, they have the right before the court, if I'm reading that correctly. And I would be curious as to the consideration of the equality of the two groups relative to knowledge of the child and the security of information. There's probably no group that scrutinized more than foster parents.
How many foster parents... How many foster parents cease to be foster parents within the first year? There must be a reason for having that time period. Is there a risk learning curve? Is there a drop-off rate? Is there a reason why?
No.
Go
no.
ahead. Mr. Travis.
The reason... It's an
arbitrary... yourself again.
I'm Timothy Travis, Oregon Judicial Department. It's an arbitrary time period. And it's an arbitrary time period because it is... There are policy reasons why you don't necessarily want to give that party status too soon to a person who is a foster parent. The policy reason, and I'm not advocating this, I'm just explaining it. The policy reason is that if you give those kind of rights to a foster parent too early, you may well interfere with the return of the child to the parent. Because constitutionally, our first duty is to return the child to the parent. Whether we do that quickly enough. You've heard testimony today that there's a question about whether we do that quickly enough, mm-hmm. whether we decide yes or no quickly enough. But it's essentially it's for the administrative convenience of the agency that we do not immediately give that status to the foster parent.
That's a constitutional requirement.
There's a constitutional requirement that before somebody can be on the same level as a biological parent,
yeah.
they have to at least have a parent relationship with the child. And that parent relationship with the child is described in 419B116. Foster parents very quickly get to that point, much quicker than 12 months. If they weren't foster parents and they had that relationship, they could be an intervener sooner than 12 months.
Is there a way of granting that... that relationship within the 12-month period on a this opens another can of worms on a per case. I mean, that would require them to, or someone, a caseworker or someone, to say, okay, you have achieved that status and we can give you that.
The person who would make that decision would be the judge. And the closer to zero you get, from 12 months to zero, then I think, I'm just speculating, there would be more disagreement. And if there's more disagreement, then there's more hearings. And as you get more hearings, you start to come in at some point, you get to the point of a fiscal.
Timothy, I understand what you're saying, and you know, I think, Mr. Chair, in my opinion, I think we move the bill, and if it needs some more scrutiny, we can do it as it moves through the process. But from my perspective, you know, what this does is give more complete discovery for the judge to have better information to make a decision. And you know, let's assume that the judges are intelligent individuals and they know who is who. So, I mean, from my perspective, this is just that I think this helps with the discovery process in the trial.
Do you agree?
No, okay.
We don't make the laws, we enforce the laws. Whatever you say they are, we'll do it.
No, I understand that. I want to hear the counter argument if there is a counter argument.
As I said earlier.
All due respect to Senator Cruz, if you disagree with him, I would like to hear why.
He's never been shy about that.
I have never disagreed with Senator Cruz. I disagreed with Representative Cruz a few times. But
you haven't had time to disagree with Senator Cruz. Okay. Did you have anything else?
No, I'm just here to provide information.
Yes.
Yeah. To me, and I don't know the ramifications of this bill, first and foremost is in the best interest of the child. The child is first and foremost. And I would hope that in the system that we have right now, that the interest of the child is first and foremost, whether it's with the foster parents or the parents, whoever. So, you know, allowing foster, I just don't know enough about the system to know whether foster parents, you know, if this... if this is good for the child, I would hope that if this went through, that it wouldn't conflict with what was in the best interest of the child.
I was being preoccupied. What was your final statement?
Best interest of the child, and I don't know if this legislation will hurt or hinder the process that we have now.
Okay, Senator Starr, did you have any comments on this?
Let's move the bill and keep working on it.
Okay. Other comments? Okay.
One last comment. With all due respect to Senator George's statement that DHS pulled the grievance piece out of the amendment is inaccurate. I actually provided statements that talked about that, and it was what I understood from Jim Thompson, who spoke earlier, that it was through Legislative Council, so it was not DHS. I think it's important to note that.
We'll call that a Scribner's error, and
we'll go from there. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Mr. Chairman, like the State Senator Gary George, I'm very pleased to have them supportive of that bill. I think that's an important part of the bill, the grievance process.
Okay, we are going to close the public hearing, and we're going to open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 Amendment, Senate Bill 815.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 Amendments to Senate Bill 815.
Well, we've got a discussion, objections, that sort of thing, and then we'll do that.
Are we okay with the Dash 2 Amendments?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I will vote for it.
Other comments?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be voting no, reserving the right to vote for the bill when it moves forward. With my extended committee today, I have not had the opportunity to have the full knowledge of this information, so it would be, I think, inappropriate to support something that I really haven't had an opportunity to hear the testimony.
Okay.
And that doesn't mean I won't support it once I've had a chance for the review. So assuming you have the sufficient votes, I would be voting no. I think that would be the prudent thing at this point.
Okay. Let's call the roll, please. On the Dash 2 amendment.
On the Dash 2.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
No.
Senator Montanus?
Aye.
Senator Charles Starr?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Okay, the Dash 2 amendments are accepted.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 815 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senate Bill 815 is moved to the floor for due pass recommendation. Discussion. Okay. I have a few doubts, a few twinges. I'm hoping that any flaws that are fatal flaws will bubble at the top. I hope that if we hear from the departments or legal counsel somewhere along the way, that will be made known. The bill will probably be on the floor of the Senate in the next week or so. It will then go to the House, and there will be some time over there. And if there are any compelling arguments why any of the pieces of this bill should not be in it, then there will be an opportunity to work on it again. I have a few doubts. I have a lot of good feelings about the bill because I think I agree with Mr. Travis in his characterization of people who are foster parents, and I think that they in many ways have a thankless, can be a thankless job. I mean, they're devoting not only their time, their love, their homes. It's an investment in the children that they are good enough to take into their home. So I have the highest regard and greatest respect for people who do that. And I think oftentimes the state, as any bureaucracy does, is not always consistent in its application of the rules, as was apparent by Mr. Travis's comments about the one judge that did not provide the hearing. And that's obviously, well, I shouldn't say obviously, that's an exception, I guess. Standing, I maybe didn't understand the full scope of standing in terms of entitlement to information that they will achieve at some point. That was a good clarification. After a certain period of time, they do have that. So the question is, when are they to get that? On the other hand, I understand that during the first few months, it may be difficult to give all that information and then suddenly have to remove the child from the home for some reason that was not known until after 2 or 3 months. And so that's the part that I guess I'm a little bit concerned about. If there is a good reason, I guess, for that year in some ways, maybe it should be shortened. Maybe there should be another way of deciding when they should attain that. So overall, I have faith in what's going to happen. I think it's a good bill, and so...
Mr. Chair, you've all of a sudden brought up some issues with litigation. If things like this are in statute, and then a foster parent, therefore, doesn't feel that they have been provided respect or support services, or is litigation going to be an issue then?
Do you have a question? Should we, did you want to call one of the witnesses?
Well, if this is going to open the door for litigation, we haven't even crossed.
Timothy Travis, would you come back up, please?
Boy, call out the
door. Okay, I guess we are. Okay, this is a part of the work session.
Chair Morissette. Yeah, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. I'm Mickey Logan. I'm a senior assistant attorney general. I've represented the Department of Human Services for over 12 years in juvenile court. And I agree with everything Mr. Travis has said thus far. But I was waiting for this issue to arise about litigation because in the many years that I've been representing Department of Human Services, and as I know the new senators are aware, assistant attorneys general are not called very often to juvenile court, at least here's 4-2. And I've been in well over 1,000 hearings for DHS, and I can tell you, lots of those hearings are litigation because interveners get involved, and then we have disputes about whether services are being provided, whether the child should be going home, whether the child should stay in foster care, whether the foster parent should get custody, whether the grandparent should get custody, yada, yada, yada. And I am certain there will be more litigation and this is not just to misspeak about foster parents, because they're usually my best witnesses, but they always have been. I have never had a bad experience with with a foster parent. But you add anyone as an additional party to a juvenile court case, and you are necessarily going to have more litigation. Anyone. You pick any intervener. We already in juvenile court hearings have the child's attorney, CASAs, state. We have anyone who's intervened. I mean, I've had hearings with 10 parties sitting there. So I think the the you need to be considering what the potential impact on litigation would be, which is why, and I don't know the legislative history, I know that it did get reduced from 18 months to 12 months, but there was a lot of discussion about why it shouldn't go less than 12 months at that point. I'm not sure if that was 1997. I think it was 1997. So that was a well-thought-out issue at that time.
The lowering from 18 to 12 months was a compromise in 1997 between people who thought it was way too long and people who thought it shouldn't be at all. So it was a compromise. As to the question of whether or not passing this bill is going to lead to more litigation, my colleague is correct. Anytime you add more chefs in the kitchen, there's more opinions about how much paprika you need, you know. But whether or not putting something into a foster parent's bill of rights and having a foster parent come in and say, it says here you're supposed to respect me, and you didn't show up at 3 o'clock like you said you would, you didn't get there until 5, I don't think we're going to find that kind of litigation is going to be happening. In terms of what information foster parents are going to get, you're always going to find a battle there, always. But if there's a statute, there's something there that you can build policy on. But I don't know that the kind of litigation that I think that Senator Moss Anderson was referring to, I don't know that that's going to increase just based on what's in the statute.
And I should clarify, Chair Morissette and committee, I'm talking about that provision which would make them an automatic party from the beginning of the case. That's the only provision I'm referring to. I'm not speaking to the bill as a whole.
And can I just take a second and reiterate what I've said a number of times, because sometimes it gets lost in the mix. The Judicial Department is neutral on this bill. We respect foster parents, and we want to do everything we can to help them. But I'm not here today advocating any particular policy. As I said earlier, you decide and we'll carry it out. That's our job as the Judicial Department.
And my boss, Mr. Myers, would probably appreciate it if I pointed out the Department of Human Services, Mr. George and Ms. Ledesma, asked me to come up and express my experience. I'm not speaking on behalf of the Department of Justice.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Would the clerk call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Senator Moss Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Charles Starr?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye.
I cough, you must turn your ass.
Senator Cruz is a...
You got me as a yes, right? It was sign language.
Okay, the bill has passed, and Senator George will carry the bill, and you better do a good job.
I'm telling you, I try to answer every one of these questions, and if not, we'll have an acceptable alternative.
Okay, I just want to say this has been a very good hearing. I thought we covered a lot of ground. This is an act of faith in some ways, on my part anyway, that we are making progress and doing the right thing. Now, I guess it remains to be seen in 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, if the legislature doesn't come back and say, we got to make a change because this is not working. So I guess this is, nothing is permanent, I guess, when you're dealing with our business. And I think we're moving forward, and
everything's permanent for 2 years.
Everything's permanent. Okay, thank you. We'll close the work session. Okay. Senate Bill 895, we're going to open a public hearing, and we're going to call up Senator Starr, and we're going to call up Mr. Dugan. You have to leave soon, do you, Mr. Dugan?
Senator, I can stay
until my time. Okay, why don't you just wait then a few minutes, and we'll hear from Senator Starr first of all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, it's Senator Bruce Starr, Senate District 15, representing Western Washington County.
I appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 895. Mr. Chair, I appreciate your hearing this bill. This bill deals with a very difficult circumstance. That's the circumstance where the state exerts one of its most frightening powers, the power to remove children from families. Clearly, there are circumstances where this power is required and necessary. But I believe that the additional requirements in Senate Bill 895 are also important. The rights of families and children in these unfortunate situations are important to be closely adhered to. Child abuse investigators should have an absolute handle on the rights of the families that they are that they're dealing with. And I'm not going to go into great additional testimony. We've got folks that will testify in support of the bill. I will tell you, Mr. Chair, that I have had conversations with Mickey Cerise from the Department of Human Services that have raised a couple of issues with the bill. One of it is that this bill would require them to have child investigators have additional training. They would have to contract that training out, probably to the Department of Justice. There'd be some minimal cost to that. So, and since that cost isn't anticipated in the governor's budget, there's a concern there. The underlying bill, though, the department supports just this issue of cost, and I think we're talking about a very small cost, and I think we'll hear testimony, too, of other states that have done this kind of training, that we could replicate the training. So, again, the cost ought to be minimal. We've also, there may be the possibility of that BPSST already does similar training for law enforcement. There might be opportunity that they could do this training as well. So there might be, again, opportunity to take care of the cost issues that have been raised. I also, Mr. Chair, just since I walked in the back of the room 15 minutes ago, learned that the district attorneys had concerns about this bill, primarily because if you look on the bill on the on page 2, on line 14, we include, and I think this was an inadvertent inclusion. I don't believe we anticipated or wanted this to happen, but we included law enforcement agency. And I think you'll hear from Mr. Dugan and the representatives of the district attorneys that that's a problem. We recognize that. And we would be happy to strike five words or the law enforcement agency because I think that they are correct. And I've talked to some other supporters of the bill, and then that's not a problem, and we would be happy to strike those words. So I think, the fiscal issue that you're going to hear, I think, is something that's going to be way below the $50,000 threshold that typically sends a bill to Ways and Means, and I think we're talking as low as $2,000, maybe as much as $10,000, depending on whether it's a videotape training or whether it's, you pay a Department of Justice attorney to stand and do a seminar kind of a situation. And so I think the fiscal is really small, and I think we can deal with the concerns of our friends, the district attorneys, and the law enforcement community. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I appreciate the opportunity to kind of be the leadoff hitter here on this bill, and I'm very thankful that you've scheduled for a hearing. If we could get a -1 amendments to strike those words, or you could handle that at some point, or we could do it in the House if there was comfort level doing that. I'd love to have the opportunity to move this bill through the process. I do think that what we're talking about here is important. These are, as you've heard in your previous testimony, other bill, and when you're dealing with families, I mean, these are very difficult situations to deal with, and I think having agents of the state, and that's what these investigators are, where they have a complete and full handle on what statutory constitutional rights of families are and the children. I think it is really, really critical. So I think the bill is important. At this point, Mr. Chair, my phone is buzzing, my wife is calling, and with your permission, would like to turn the dais over to others that are on the testimony list.
Thank you. I just want to say that this bill has sentimental value to me. This, not the bill itself, but the number, Senate Bill 895, because I opened my folder today and I found my old bill from last year that didn't go through. So.
Thank
so
you.
Immediately I thought, gee, this is a great bill.
So it wasn't a number after all, was it, Senator?
Not that simple, but I did have highlighted the section that you were concerned about, and so I will call the AGs up to talk about that. Would you please come up and identify yourselves?
Chairman Morsetti and members of the committee, I'm Mike Dugan. I'm the district attorney from Deschutes County. With me today on my immediate right is Tara Lawrence, who's the district attorney from Sherman County. And my far right is Kamala Sugar, who is a deputy district attorney from, I believe, your county, Lane County.
Yes.
And we appreciate direction that the committee has taken with regard to deleting that portion of the bill that talks about and law enforcement agencies, because we think it's real important that law enforcement agencies have all their current ability to investigate, to protect children, and we hope that that will be done that way. And we also believe that training for DHS and particularly Children Protective Service workers is very important. And I'm sure that the District Attorney Association will be asked to participate in that training. We'll be available should we be called. I'm not sure if my colleagues have anything more to add, but we certainly appreciate the committee's attention.
All we've got to do is strike five words, line 14, page 2, and we're golden with you, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Kamala Sugar from the Oregon District Attorneys Association, Lane County. We will take it to our committee tonight to confirm that. but it's our anticipation that that will be the case.
Well,
and we wanted to make
no
sure
that...
will
no longer be referred in the bill, so you shouldn't have a problem at that
That's
point.
Correct.
So.
there are some of us, myself included, that handle the juvenile cases, though, and I would like to confer with people who are handling those to see if there are any concerns or questions.
Okay. Thank you. That's important. I mean, what are some of the unintended consequences that this might have that affect your department?
Well, Chair Morissette and members of the committee, any time that there's an investigation into child abuse, even if it is a caseworker with the Department of Human Services, if they're the person who makes the initial contact with the suspect, mm-hmm. and let me give an example. There's an allegation that a child has been physically abused. Mm-hmm. They go to make the initial contact with the suspect. They say, there's an allegation that you've physically abused your child.
Okay.
So they do make the disclosure required in the statute.
No.
Further conversation with that suspect reveals that there's actually also child sexual abuse going on. Does that then preclude anybody from proceeding based on this? I think that could be clarified so that it's perhaps at the time of the initial contact shall inform the person of the specific currently known allegations. Because their investigations develop, and a lot of times there's incidental types of abuse that surround one that you know about.
But if I could ask a question.
Yes.
Maybe it's just some wordsmithing here, but I mean, as I read it, and there may be further allegations coming, but if they're informing of what they know, I don't think it can be held because they didn't inform of what they didn't know.
Well, that as long as the legislative history is clear on that matter, and there isn't an intent for any kind of what if a child made some comments but they weren't clear, there was some allusion to the fact that there might be sexual abuse but it was never actually disclosed, and people want to look into that without having to go into any detail further than that. I mean, this is how these investigations happen.
Right.
And I've gotten to see it kind of firsthand. So.
He's used to being a chair, and I have a hard time controlling him. Okay. Do you have the copy in front of you?
I do.
Okay. Tell me what you think it should say or not say.
Well, Chair Morissette, members of the committee, it would be helpful, at least with regard to that point, mm-hmm. to say something such as...
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Inform the person of known allegations made against the person. The word specific concerns me quite a bit. I can take this back to our committee this evening. I'd be happy to recontact you.
We're going to have to come back to this because this is an important part of it, and we want to get it right. So we will not move forward with this at this time, but we will bring it back.
We are certainly, Chairman and members of the committee, certainly willing to work in any way with the committee and with the sponsors to make this bill work, because we think education is important for the Children Protective Services.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and it's good to see you again.
And you'll see me again and again, I'm sure.
Okay. I'd like to just move on to another bill now, because we have a lot of other bills. We're going to close the public hearing on this bill because we have some work to do with it, but we will bring it back for another hearing and we'll move the bill, hopefully. Yeah. So did we lose everybody?
You got me. Is Lori gone, or is she just stepped out?
Rick is here.
That was
here.
Bad news, wasn't it?
No. Rick is here. About 30 for a second. Yeah. We're going to stand at ease for just a moment to see if we have enough people to continue our hearing. Jim Marquis, would you come up, and Bruce, and would you...
Just briefly, Chair, this is a bill that requires name badges for several different practitioners at their respective boards to set by policy for use in their healthcare facilities. Thank you.
Mr. Marquis, would you identify yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Jim Marquis, I'm representing the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists. This bill was brought to you at the request of the Anesthesiologists Society. As originally written, there was some opposition. We have worked with all of the affected parties for the last couple of months. Dotted I's and crossed T's. The result of that effort are the Dash 2 amendments. They simply require healthcare practitioners working at healthcare facilities and providing direct care to patients to wear identification badges indicating their name and professional title. Healthcare facilities would adopt policies that specify size, content, etc. of those badges. These amendments have been vetted through the Oregon Hospital Association, the Nurses Association, the Treatment Centers, Physicians Assistants, Medical Association, Association of Nurse Anesthetists, the long-term facilities. There is no opposition to this bill that I know of. We would urge the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments and that you send the bill to the floor with a due pass. Be happy to answer any questions.
Bruce, you okay?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am okay. Thank you very much. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We have worked with Mr. Marquis on the amendments. The Dash 2 amendments are far preferable to the original bill and the Dash 1s, and in the event that there are further amendments, we expect the bill to continue to improve.
Is that an example of the badge that people will be wearing, the one that you're wearing? Is that
Mr. Chair, I'm wearing a badge that identifies myself as the Vice President of the Capital Club.
Oh, very good. But it's about that size and shape. And
Bruce tells me he gets a lot more respect when he wears that badge.
So badges not only identify you, but in some cases you get respect if you wear
one. That's right.
Very good. Okay, thank you very much. Others wishing to testify? Seeing no one wishing to testify in this public hearing, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 620. And we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 620.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment, Senate Bill 620.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 620. Comments, concerns? Seeing none, they are moved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 620 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senate Bill 620 has been moved by Senator Cruz to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please? Any discussion? No discussion. Call the roll, please.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Montana?
Aye.
Senator Charles Starr?
Excuse.
Chair Morissette?
Aye.
Help me, Bill.
Okay. Senate Bill 620 will go to the floor and. Would you like to carry the bill?
Sure.
Okay. Senator Cruz will carry the bill. We're going to do Senate Bill 668. Close the public hearing. Close the work session. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 668. All right, Cleo, would you come up, please? And would you read the summary?
Thank you, Chair. This bill we did here on the 1731st establishes a physician means licensed chiropractor, naturopath, a doctor of medicine, Dr. Vasilevsky. We do have dash one amendments that change the bill, prohibited public discrimination against classification physicians. So thank you, Chair.
Okay. Oh, okay. We'll go to the public hearing. Art?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Art Kyle, representing the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. The last time this bill was up, I asked that it be held because I was attempting to negotiate a dash two amendment.
Okay.
I talked with Dr. Tina Kitchen from OMAP Insurance, John Powell, the OMA, and prepared an amendment, mm-hmm. which I took to legislative counsel in the form of Charlie Cheek, and he told me that several things, but one of them, none of these provisions that we were considering would cut the mustard for the legal part of the issue. And he also said that no way would state statute supersede federal regulations, so that those issues were not heard. If I may, Mr. Chairman, there are two issues I'd like to raise for the committee. The first one is that ORS 676110 is the list of professions using defined as physicians, and they're already in statute. And from that statute, the Attorney General, item number two, wrote, if I may read this, when used without further qualification, physician generally is meant to mean any professional class of persons who use the term under Oregon statutes. Last one, if I may, ORS 676-1110 authorized podiatrists, chiropractors, naturopaths, osteopaths, medical doctors to use the word physician. There's a fiscal impact that was prepared, Mr. Chairman, my last item. This, and at the end of the fiscal impact, which they've generated $185,000 to employ 9,400 employees from 2,300 entities, reads, to the extent this measure would prompt public bodies to purchase additional insurance riders to allow newly defined physicians, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Physicians have been defined. The purpose of this bill was to allow naturopaths to sign certain state-generated forms, not to reestablish physician in the statute. It's been already placed there. It is cleared by two attorney general opinions, and we can't go beyond that point.
Okay. I don't think we have the constitutional means to pass this bill at the present time, so we'll go ahead and close the public hearing.
Thank
and
you.
We will continue working on it, and if we can get there, we will rehear it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
There.
Chairman.
Yes, yeah, thanks. Okay, we're going to hear Senate Bill 1005. Open a public hearing. Representative Mark, would you come up, please? Go ahead and read the bill.
Thank you, Senator. I will probably defer to Representative March read his bill last week, and basically it sets allocates certain public utility funds for deaf communication to setting up regional centers and services for people who are deaf and hard of hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, this is Robert Pope. He is a deaf individual. He became deaf at the age of 6, and I won't read his whole testimony, but you have copies that are being passed out. He's in his testimony, he talks about the lack of services for the deaf and hard of hearing and how it caused him to be held back and actually have a mental breakdown almost. When he finally did get services in California, it made a huge difference in his life. And that's why he's strongly supporting Senate Bill 1005. You have Dash 1 amendments that I brought to you last time. It cleans up a little bit of the language in the statute. In fact, the current statute doesn't properly continuously appropriate the Public Utility Commission funds. So that is taken care of on line 16 of the Dash 1s. I'm asking the committee to do is to move this bill. It's going to go on to Ways and Means. I'm working with the telecommunications with representatives of the telecommunications industry. I've already had conversations with a number of them around the 5 cent issue, and I do not intend to move a full 5 cent issue. The full 5 cents that's in this bill. I hope to reach a compromise with representatives of the industry. Things look favorable, but I do not expect it to come out of Ways and Means with that 5 cents in it. I hope that we have some figure that we can reach a good compromise on, and I will work very hard with members of the telecommunications industry to ensure that it does not hurt their industry. Up until January, 13 cents was gathered under the current telecommunications charge. That's just been rolled back to 10 cents. So the jump to 15 may be too large, and I'd like to seek rolling it back to the 13 cents that was being charged up until January, or some figure that we can reach an agreement on, and that's why I would ask your support at this time, and I'll continue working with the industry.
Yes, sir. Would you introduce him?
This is Robert Pope. I introduced him. You have written testimony from him.
Okay.
We don't have a sign language interpreter with us today, but I you've got copies of his testimony.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. Any others testifying? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1005, and we will open the work session on Senate Bill 1005.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1005.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments to 1005. Any objections? Seeing none, we will move those Dash 1s.
Mr. Chair, I will move Senate Bill 1005 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1005 to Ways and Means without recommendation. Discussion.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I will be voting against this. It's a tax increase.
Okay. Other comments?
And, Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I will be giving a courtesy yes to get it to Ways and Means.
Okay. I would like to say that I very much favor this bill. I think that it is important to the community, the deaf community, that they have this. I think that it isn't an imposition on our electorate, or, I mean on our constituents, on the taxpayers, an undue imposition. So I do support the bill, and I will see what I can do to move along in the Ways and Means. You've moved the dash ones, and so we're ready to... you've moved the bill?
Yes, we're ready for the vote.
Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Perry?
No.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Juan Sanderson?
Aye.
Senator Charles Starr?
Excuse.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Thank you. The Senate Bill 1005 will be sent to Ways and Means with no recommendation. Thank you. Let's see. Yeah, we're going to have a work session on Senate Bill 70. Would you describe the bill, please?
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 870 defines disabled person, someone who is eligible for a supplemental security income. It expands the Oregon Project Independence to provide help to eligible clients in their home when they can no longer care for themselves. It requires that appropriate funds include crisis services, respite, special needs, and other services. It does appropriate general funds. Repeals separate fund account for people over 60 years of age and Alzheimer's disease. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill.
Which bill? I'm sorry.
870.
870.
We're in work session
now. Yeah, we are in work session.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 870.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 870. Discussion? Seeing none? Yes. Yes.
Okay. Just a minute. I try to find it. No amendment.
Oh, yes, it's dash one.
The dash one. Okay. Would you like to describe the dash one amendments, please? He just came away.
Here, have mine.
Thank you, Chair. These do define crisis services. It does maintain that they are provided for a limited period of time. Establishes that the OPI is establishing primary human service support for providing eligible clients, providing public information in case of long-term care, and offering long-term care case management. And if the department is not able to contract with an authorized agency to provide these services, they may contract with another organization. It does still target services, and there's still an appropriation of general fund for this service. Thank you, Chair.
So you're not in favor of the dash one amendments? Okay. Well, I guess we will close the public hearing. The work session, I'm sorry, we'll close the work session, and we may revisit the bill at another time. I did talk to our Ways and Means member, Senator Gourley and Senator Carter, about this bill and whether or not they felt it was okay to add disabled to the population who would benefit from Project Independence, and they both said that was fine to pass this bill to Ways and Means. I served on a senior and disabled commission 2 years ago, and one of the complaints that came from the disabled community is that the attention was basically given to the seniors and not the disabled, and that there were many disabled individuals who needed in-home assistance and could benefit from Project Independence, and that they felt that it was basically unfair for them not to be included. But I did want to check with two members, and I'm sorry I didn't check with the third member on the Ways and Means, or on the subcommittee of Ways and Means. I know that Senator Carter, one of her main priorities is long-term care. She didn't distinguish between the disabled or the seniors. So anyway, we will go back and try it one more time. We will, the bill, we're not going to, obviously we don't have the votes to pass the bill. But we
Mr.
will
Chair?
Look at, yeah.
Oregon Project Independence is in our budget. We are allotting money to it, and this bill just says to expand OPI, and we have OPI, and we have gone through the Ways and Means process and a prioritization, so really this bill isn't necessary because it's on our agenda.
Well, I'm not sure, though, that the disabled community is included. No, I'm sorry. I'm not sure the disabled community, but we can have this discussion, and if we may bring this bill back. We'll have a discussion about this. So I'm sorry we didn't have the discussion before. Okay. There, were you here? Well, okay.
We had the discussion in Sweet Home.
Oh, okay. We did have the discussion in Sweet Home. Yeah, okay. Well. Okay, we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill, where will it be? Senate Bill 870, and we are opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 609, and Senator Cruz, Ms. Swanson, did you want to? Is she here? Yeah.
I'm trying to get somebody on the phone. Okay.
Oh, yeah, we did have that discussion. We don't.
Long one.
Hmm?
Long one.
Yeah.
Why don't we move it?
Are we waiting for
Danny?
I'm calling for Miss Berkeley.
Yes, this is she.
This is Rick Berkobian. You're on a conference call with a public hearing. There's somebody testifying right now, reading a letter from Senator Winters, and then we'll let you testify, and then someone from the Department of Human Services, so just please hold with us.
That's fine.
Okay, you want to read?
Okay.
Read.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to read testimony.
Okay, Senator Cruz.
Well, I get to my name in here.
Oh, you do? Okay,
yes, I do. But I am Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This testimony on Senate Bill 609-1 amendments from Senator Jackie Winters, who, as we all know, is in a recovery mode from a triple bypass and is not here at this late hour, nor should she be. So she asked me, this was my bill, and she asked me if she could use it for the Dash One Amendment, and I said certainly that she could, and so this is her statement, Mr. Chair. Chair Morissette and members of the Senate Health Committee, in my absence, I have asked Vice Chair Jeff Cruz to read my statement in the public record. I respectfully request that the Dash One Amendments be accepted by the Senate Health Committee, and this bill be passed out and given an opportunity to be voted on by the full Senate. Three separate yet combined issues are combined in the Dash One Amendments. A situation was brought to my attention by a constituent who, as the custodial parent, had her young child unknowingly and without authorization taken by the non-custodial parent to a physician for an exam, then to an abuse assessment center, and ultimately removed from the home by DHS. No allegations of abuse were made against the custodial parent, yet the above-mentioned scenario played out. The custodial parent was not informed of anything until she was contacted by DHS the next day and informed that her daughter was now in protective custody as a result of the allegations. She was given little information after the assessment as to who, what, why, or when, leaving her in a state of shock. The Dash One Amendments would make three simple requirements of DHS, excuse me, Mr. Chair, the Department of Human Services, okay, to ensure that this does not occur in the future. Please be assured that if there are abuse allegations against the custodial parent, immediate intervention by law enforcement and Department of Human Services would override a similar situation. The amendments would, one, require custodial parent consent to any assessment or evaluation of the child conducted as part of the abuse investigation prior to the assessment or evaluation. Two, the custodial parent would be given a copy of the assessment or evaluation no later than 48 hours after the department receives the assessment or evaluation. Three, and the person taking the child into protective custody shall notify the custodial parent the same day. I believe the Department of Human Services and abuse assessment centers across Oregon take on a huge responsibility in the mandate to protect our children from abuse and neglect. But we must also be diligent in protecting the rights of custodial parents when allegations of such abuses are made. That is her statement.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Annie Barkley.
Yes. Ms. Barkley, would you identify yourself, please, for the record?
Yes, and I apologize in advance. I have a lost voice, so if I'm difficult to understand, please let me know. My given name is Elizabeth Ann Barkley, and I go by Annie.
Okay. Go ahead and testify.
Well, I just want to say that I am very, very much in support of Senator Winter's bill that she is proposing. I've been read a copy of it over the phone. I haven't seen it in person, but everything that she is asking for in the bill I support and thoroughly agree with. And all I want to do is see that this doesn't happen to another family and another custodial parent as it did to me.
Okay.
And I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone might like to ask of me.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. No questions. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. If I can be of any further assistance, please don't hesitate to contact me.
Okay. You can stay on the phone for a few minutes, though.
Okay.
Ms. Swanson.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, and I appreciate this time to share some concern.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to just recess for just a minute, because if we're going to pass this bill, we need to have the people in here to hear the testimony. We can't